Hello once again and welcome to the Common Sense Gospel. I am Danny Simmons.
And I'm Kurt Norbert.
And we are looking at Samson. This is Samson Part 2. We had begun our study last week. And if you recall with us, you've not heard that episode, you should certainly listen to it so you'll be with us as we step into Part 2. But we ended Samson Part 1 at the end of Chapter 14, Judges 14. Samson sees a daughter of the Philistines, and he says to his father and his mother, "She pleases me well." He and his parents go down to Timnah to get her, and on the way down, Samson is surprised by a young lion that came roaring against him. He tears the lion in half as a man tears a young goat. So they go down from there. He leaves the lion laying there. They go down from there. They meet the girl and her family, and then they return home. And so they know they're expecting to come back and to have this marriage ceremony take place. When Samson comes back down for the wedding feast, he goes to see the lion, and the carcass is there still where he left it, but there is a beehive in it. Some bees have made a hive, and they've made honey. And so he reaches in and grabs honey out of this dead animal's carcass, and then he brings this to his parents. And we talked about that last episode, that he doesn't tell them where he got it, but he does share it with them. And we figured they'd be less likely to partake if they knew that it was roadkill honey, but they did anyway because they weren't made aware. He eats it himself, gives it to his parents. And at the beginning of the wedding feast, now they're all there, Samson poses a riddle to the Philistine companions that were given to him. They can't solve the riddle, so they threaten his bride-to-be. And she pressed him so much about the answer to that riddle that he finally tells her on the seventh day, so that it's almost time for the wedding. She is driving him crazy, and he finally says, "All right, here's the answer." So that same day before the sun went down, the Philistine men come to Samson, and they tell him the answer to the riddle. And he is so upset. He says, "If you had not plowed with my heifer, you would have never known the answer to that riddle." But he knows the deal he made when he posed the riddle, that he owes them 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothing. So in his furious rage, he goes down to Ashkelon, tells us he kills 30 of their men, and he brings the clothing back to the men of Timnah. And he's so angry about this in that moment that he goes home and he does not consummate the marriage, which is what should have happened. And so the girl's father thinks that Samson is gone for good, and he gives his daughter to Samson's best man. Whoever was brought in as one of the Philistines to be Samson's best man is now this man of Timnah, the husband of his daughter. Poor girl.
Yeah, I imagine if they'd had shotguns back then, that it would be a shotgun wedding. I'm sure this best man was thoroughly surprised. Yeah, I didn't come here to get married. I wasn't seeking a bride. But, it shows the way that cultures operated back then, the way societies were, and just how unpredictable Samson is. I mean, he is kind of at the mercy of his emotions. He's extremely impulsive. You don't know what's going to set him off. He just goes off on some of what we think are the strangest things just because he decides, "I'm going to go do it." But remembering what's behind all of this, Samson was raised up because God was going to deliver the people from their 40-year oppression by the Philistines through Samson. He's another judge or deliverer. And on this occasion, God is going to use this judge to relieve the people of the domination of the Philistines. And we see that cycle throughout the book of Judges. Some group like the Midianites or the Egyptians, whatever, is oppressing the people because they have disobeyed God. They repent and plead for help, and God raises up a judge. And so we're looking in this case at Samson versus the Philistines, and we're going to see another episode of him going after the Philistines and God using him to seek an occasion against the Philistines.
That's right, and it is coming. We're going to step into chapter 15 and watch that together. As you were discussing, you know, how odd it is, and the culture's different, so we're not in tune to all of this. And this may seem very normal for them, where the father says, "She was prepped to be married, and I have already sold her room or rented her room to somebody," or however that works. And he says, "She's going to marry somebody." So he chooses, it seems, the best man. But if you go back and look at the story, we know nothing about this guy except he's a Philistine. And we know one other thing. He's one of the 30 companions who went to her and told her what? If you don't tell us the answer to this riddle, we're going to burn you and your father's house with fire. Now he's married to her. That's so crazy. I feel so bad. We don't know the girl. We don't know her name. We can't know any more about her because it's not given to us. But this is terrible.
And it's the father who gives her away, which was normal back in those societies. So you're right. Here's this guy that threatened the family with murder, with destruction. And now, hi, son-in-law.
Hey, Dad, can I borrow the keys to the car?
Come on over here and marry my daughter. Oh, man. It's amazing.
It really is. But we do things like that, too, that aren't far from that.
So. Oh, yeah. The customs are customs. And back in those days, you followed custom. It's quite possible that if some kind of marriage wasn't gone through here, that would be some sort of a societal insult or, you know, she's belittled now in the eyes of others. Yeah. So, like you said, the father's got to do something about this. And so he gives her away to a potential murderer. So it's the Philistines were an interesting people.
Yes, they
were. So was Samson.
Yeah, and they're going to meet again here. So here we go, chapter 15 and verse 1. After a while, so Samson has cooled off after returning home and being so furious with this riddle problem. After a while, in the time of the wheat harvest, it happened that Samson visited his wife with a young goat, and he said, "Let me go into my wife, into her room." But her father would not permit him to go in. Her father said, "I really thought that you thoroughly hated her. Therefore, I gave her to your companion. Is not her younger sister better than she is? Please take her instead." And Samson said to them, "This time I shall be blameless regarding the Philistines if I harm them." So that didn't take long. He's mad again. We're told he's come down after he's calmed down during the wheat harvest. This is about mid-May, as I understand the timeline, and when, you know, it's time to harvest the wheat. And he brings a young goat with him. It's customary to bring a gift. Maybe he feels a little bad and he's a little apology present. You know, here's a goat. What do you think?
That or part of a dowry. Yeah. That's what was required back then. The bridegroom was expected to bring some value, give a gift to the daughters or the bride-to-be's family. He would basically pay her dowry. So it may be this goat is part of that. Or all of it, but clearly it's a gift of some sort.
You see Samson walking down the road, just kind of swinging this goat like a keychain, you know, around his finger.
Well, I guess you could say he's got his goat.
He's about to get his goat got here in a second.
Yeah, that's for sure.
So think about this: he goes to the father. He talks to the father first, and he says, "Give me my wife that I may go into her." And you know, just imagine Samson standing in front of this one Philistine man. And says the man would not permit him. Samson's standing there. He is the strongest character in all the Bible that we have any record of. And this guy says, "Nope, you're not going in there." You know, and so he's already starting to boil. "Don't you tell me no." He would not permit him. And then he adds fuel to the fire. "I thought you hated her, so I gave her to your companion or the best man of your wedding." If I was that guy, I'd say, "You can go in there, but there's somebody else in there too. So just be aware, you know, good luck." I would not stand in Samson's way. But in order to appease Samson, I think he can see it on his face that he can tell this is not going to go well. This guy's angry. He says, "Here's my younger daughter. Take her. Is she not well pleasing?" So again, these things are really strange to us. An angry man from a foreign country shows up at your door and you just hand your younger daughter to him?
Well, of course, the father had already committed to giving her his daughter. So I guess he's looking at it that, okay, here's a chance for me to uphold my commitment to you. I still have another daughter. How about her? It kind of reminds me of Leah and Rachel a little bit.
Yeah.
Except that it's the father, Laban, that's playing the games on poor Jacob. But... That's the only one way I would look at it. In a way, the father may believe he's still obligated. You know, I agreed for him to take my daughter. Of course, she's unavailable, but here's another one. And she's even better than the first one. So
that was the other
please
part.
Please take her.
Is not her younger sister better than she? Yeah. Now, that could be a sales pitch. Like, hey, this one's actually better.
And in what way better? Better looking, a better worker, or, you know, what?
It's not clarified.
Yeah.
But the deal is, please take her instead. And Samson said, this time I am blameless. Now, we're going to watch him do this over and over again. And you mentioned that he's compulsive. But once he's angry, once something is done that makes him angry, then he gives himself permission to do whatever he's going to do. And we'll watch it as we come to it. But this is the first time that he says, okay, now whatever I do, I am blameless in that. So down in verse 4, it says, then Samson went and caught 300 foxes, and he took torches, turned the foxes tail to tail, put a torch between each pair of tails. When he had set the torches on fire, he let the foxes go into the standing grain of the Philistines. He burned up both the shocks and the standing grain, as well as the vineyards and the olive groves. So this is what he chooses to do to get his revenge on the Philistines. And we talked about it a little bit last episode, but how do you catch 300 foxes or jackals, probably?
Yeah, there's so many aspects of this that we kind of talked about. To think of the determination on the part of Samson, he's going to take the time. First of all, coming up with this whole scheme, I know how I'm going to get them. I'm going to light their fields on fire. For that, I'm going to need 300 foxes, or as you mentioned, possibly jackals, since they're used to running in packs. And then I'm going to tie two of them together with a torch and let them go through the fields. So now he's got to gather 300 of these animals. You're not going to do that all at one time. So he's going to have to pen him up somewhere as he's collecting all of these. So this is just a huge undertaking on the part of one individual. And as you mentioned when we were talking about this, it obviously shows Samson's skill as a hunter. He knew where to go to get these animals. Once there, he knew how to make a trap or a snare or whatever way it was that he was going to catch him. And he apparently was consistently successful at that, so he knew what he was doing.
Yeah, he's catching them, and he's not injuring them. They're, like you said, they're kept somewhere, they're preserved, they're going to do exactly what he needs them to do. And as you said, it shows his persistence. It takes a period of time. It's not easy. There's going to be hang-ups and traps that don't go off when they should. There's all kinds of frustration with trying to capture an animal, a wild animal. So we want to keep that tied to this to show how determined he is and how even the process itself would make him more angry. Once he has the 300, he brings them to the grain fields. Again, how do you transport 300 foxes? I don't know. It doesn't tell us. But he tied them. He takes two at a time, ties them tail to tail, puts torches between each pair of tails. So the torch, the wick, whatever this is that could hold the fire is not lit initially. It is tied inside the two tails. When he's ready to let them go, he lights it. And then he sets them free. And so then we talked about, you know, how quickly can fire spread anyway. The fire is an amazing thing, and it can spread quickly with a help from wind or anything else. But when you have wild animals whose tails are on fire, they are running at full speed. And they're running really aimlessly. The only thing they're trying to do is get the fire off of their tail.
Yeah, they're just running through. There's fire behind me, so I need to go this way.
Yeah.
They won't
run toward fire. So wherever another fox is set afire, they're going to go another direction, which it ends up burning everything.
Yeah.
The plan is genius.
Yeah. As it says, it burned up the grain and the shocks they had already harvested, plus vineyards and olive groves. So he started a major. Looking at this, of course, I was born and raised in California. We're used to the summer wildfires out there that just almost in no time they've burned up 10,000 acres, and it's just unbelievable. So I'm kind of familiar with this picture, but you can imagine the Philistines from a distance, even just seeing all this smoke go up, going, what in the world is going on here? That's where our fields are. So they're not happy about this situation, as you might well expect. But he, you know, his plot to get after the Philistines here has come to fruition.
Oh, boy.
He's dealt a devastating blow because that grain is for the winter. That's going to be their food. And probably a lot of it's going to be their seed crop for for the next year.
That's
so
right.
So he's really hit them where it counts here.
This is so damaging. And that was, I kept thinking about that, too. You know, the Philistine family looking out the window of their home. And it, like you said, even in California, in the day and age we live, there's some things we can do to try to stop fires. But there's a moment when firemen go, there's nothing we can do. And that's, that would be the feeling that comes onto these people's hearts. The stocks that they had already went and gathered and rolled up and bound up, it says that that was caught on fire, plus the standing grain. The work they had not yet finished is on fire. So just imagine standing there and watching all of your livelihood and your future, what your future was resting on, is burning with fire. And what that would do to you, like how that would make you feel. So he has hit them so hard. They gave his wife, one man gave his wife to his companion, and now everybody's crops are on fire because Samson thinks this is, okay, you did this to me, I'm doing this to you, and by the way, I'm blameless when I do it. That's his opinion of this. Mm-hmm. So that moves us down to verse 6. It says, then the Philistines said, now here's that moment, who's done this? Well, you know, they're looking out of the fire burning, and they answered, Samson, the son-in-law of the Timnite, because he has taken his wife and given her to his companion. So the Philistines came up and burned her and her father with fire. So she never escaped the riddle problem.
Yeah, this seems to be their fate. It's just, they got away with it one time with the whole riddle game they were playing. But she winds up, she and her father, you know, her family are gone. They wind up being burned with fire, which with the Philistines, I mean, that seems kind of extreme, but these are Philistines. They're Canaanites, very pagan. So they get their revenge. It's interesting to me that they don't immediately decide we're going to go after Samson.
Yeah.
Let's get our own people, this family over here that instigated all this, apparently. We'll nail them. Then maybe we'll figure out a way to go after Samson.
Yeah, and that's, we're going to see that too in this chapter. We're starting to see obvious respect for the man and his strength from his own people and certainly the Philistines. Like you said, they destroy her and her father's home. So the best man, now he's out of wife. There's a lot of weird things going on. Verse 7, now watch what he says. Samson said to them, since you would do a thing like this. So he's like, so you kill my wife? You know, it's like, and he forgot why they killed his wife.
Yeah.
Since you would do a thing like this, I will surely take revenge on you. And after that, I will cease. So he attacked them hip and thigh with a great slaughter. Then he went down and dwelt in the cleft of the rock of Edom. He is upset now after getting revenge and saying, okay, we're even. Now he says, you killed my wife. I'm taking revenge on you. And it's the end of it is after that, I will cease. He's almost, and I don't know if he's announcing this to them or just saying it to himself, but this will be the end of it. After I kill a bunch of you, I'm going to let the rest of this go.
Yeah, and that seems to be the case because he goes down into the wilderness. He gets away from the Philistines and essentially goes into isolation, which then leads to an interesting situation with his own people.
Yeah. Yeah, they're going to be involved here. Verse 9 says, now the Philistines went up and camped in Judah and deployed themselves against Lehi. And the men of Judah said, why have you come up against us? So they answered, we have come up to arrest Samson to do to him as he has done to us. It's important that we remember in this moment in time that the children of Israel are fully under the control of the Philistines. If you look at the time of David, which will be just a few years in the future from this moment, you know, the only character in the Bible that we have like a full layout of the armor that they wore is Goliath.
Yeah.
And he has, and it's impressive. What he's wearing is impressive. So that's interesting to me that the Israelites were not allowed to have any weapons at all. It says the Philistines, they were the ones who had the silversmiths.
The blacksmiths. To sharpen all their farming implements.
Yeah. If you wanted to farming tool sharpened as an Israelite, you had to go to a Philistine blacksmith and have them do it for you. They're not going to let them have any weapons. And so Samson goes into these men who are well-armed, and he has nothing, and he is absolutely, utterly destroying them. And so as they have full rule and reign of the Israelites, they come up against Judah, and Judah says, "Hey, what's the problem, fellas? You know, we don't want any trouble." And they say, we're not here to cause trouble. We're here to get Samson because of what he has done to us. And so in verse 11, it says, "Then 3,000 men of Judah went down to the cleft of the rock at Edom and said to Samson, 'Do you not know what the Philistines rule over us?'" That is so sad. "Do you not know that the Philistines rule over us? What is this you have done to us?" And he said to them, "As they did to me, so I have done to them." But they said to him, "We have come down to arrest you, that we may deliver you into the hand of the Philistines." Then Samson said to them, "Swear to me that you will not kill me yourselves." How many guys do we need to go get our brother?
Yeah.
10?
This gets me 3,000 of the men of Judah. This will do
the
it.
Respect.
What gets me about all this is they don't seem to recognize that this is a deliverance from the Philistines. They've got a history with judges now, because I think Samson's the eighth one, if I recall correctly.
Oh, yeah.
So they've seen this cycle. They've seen God raise men up, or a woman, as we see with Deborah. He's raised up these judges who perform great acts of deliverance as God takes his people out of their bondage. And they don't seem to get this yet with Samson. It's maybe because he's so unusual. I don't know. But rather than rallying and saying, "Hey, this guy's whacking the Philistines. Here's our chance for freedom. Let's help him out," or whatever. They just want to maintain the status quo.
That's right.
"Hey, you know, let me remind you, Samson, we're slaves to the Philistines and we're going to keep it that way, okay?" So they're willing to betray him, or not even betray him, just take him and give him to the Philistines in order to calm everything down. but it also seems to me that Samson already has the wheels spinning. "Swear to me that you won't kill me."
Yeah.
"Okay. Oh, yeah, okay.
We'll make
we got
deal.
That.
Yeah.
We'll take you down to them and deliver you. We won't kill you." So he kind of already knows maybe what he's going to do here.
He sure does. And, you said it, but they are basically telling him, "We are content to be in bondage." Now, this is God's people. He has already brought them into this land to be their land and their land alone. They were to drive out all of these foreign countries. Now they're under the rule of a foreign country in the land God promised them. And they say, "What have you done to us?" You know, it's so backwards, but there's a warning for us, because we can get used to the status quo and say, "Well, this
yes.
is the way things are. And based on the way things are, here's my position today." And you end up abandoning God and his will for your life when you do that.
Yep, especially when it comes to sin.
Absolutely.
You know, you can get used to a sin and then say, "Well, this is kind of the normality here.
And I've learned how to live with it."
Yeah, so let's not cause a ruckus. We're not going to rock the boat. We'll just maintain the status quo. Well, in that case, you're just going to get deeper into the situation that's causing the problem in the first place.
Yeah.
But you're right, it is. Here are the people of God. They've seen his deliverance. They've seen his care over them. And it's almost, well, I guess it's the same attitude they had in the wilderness. "Why'd you bring us out here? Back in Egypt, we had garlic and onions and all sorts of good stuff to eat. We're not talking about the bruised backs or anything like that, and the whips and everything. But, you know, we had some security back there in Egypt. And now we're out here in the wilderness, and we don't know what's going to happen from day to day, although God is guiding them day and night and providing them with everything that they need. That's not good enough." But it seems to be something in man where we are willing to give up our freedom to have security, or what we think is security.
Right.
And it's one of our country's founding fathers. I don't remember if it was Adams or Jefferson or Franklin, but one of them said back then that if you're willing to trade your freedom for security, you will get neither.
That's right.
Or you'll lose both.
It's always
something
true.
Along that line. Because people, man, governments cannot give you security.
No.
In fact, to give up your freedoms for that security leads to tyranny. So now what have you got? You don't have security there because they might be knocking at your door next day.
Yep.
You don't know with a tyrant. So it's a sad situation to get into when you think and take as normal. And, you know, we just want things to stay nice and steady and easy. We don't want the boat upset at all. We're happy to be slaves. Samson, you go away. We're going to take you to the Philistines so that everything's going to be just fine.
Yep. We've come down to arrest you that we may deliver you into the hand of the Philistines. We've come here, 3,000 men, to do the Philistines a favor. And Samson said to them, swear to me that you will not kill me yourselves. So they spoke to him, saying, no, but we will tie you securely and deliver you into their hand. But we will surely not kill you. And they bound him with two new ropes and brought him up from the rock. So they have him in custody. They're bringing him up, this picture of 3,000 men coming up out of Edom with the one man the Philistines want to kill. Verse 14, when he came to Lehi, the Philistines came shouting against him. So they're probably shouting in anger, but also a celebratory. He's wrapped up. He's tied up. They're going to have their way with him. So they're shouting against him. Then the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and the ropes that were on his arm became like flax that is burned with fire, and his bonds broke loose from his hands. He found a fresh jawbone of a donkey, reached out his hand and took it, and killed 1,000 men with it. Very interesting picture. They've got his hands bound. They bring him up. It is obvious that he has no power to do anything. And then just in this moment, the Lord tells us, almost as if you've got rope tied around your wrists, and then someone lights a fire in that little gap. And what happens to rope once you set it on fire? It just falls apart.
Yep. And he just throws the bonds off. Of course, again, here you see people not taking things into account, because I'm sure the exploits of Samson by this time have made news all over the land. Mm. That, you know, he's odds don't seem to bother him. He's able to defeat whatever comes up against him. But I guess they figure, well, in those previous instances, there weren't enough, 30 against one or whatever. That's nothing. If 3,000 of us go and get him and tie him up with ropes and then take him and hand him over to this army of Philistines, there's no way he's getting out of this one. But he kills 1,000 men with a jawbone of a donkey. So he defeats the army of the Philistines and inflicts a great loss on them. So once again, he's shown that in certain instances, he's capable of doing this. And of course, the whole thing behind it is that the Spirit of the Lord rushed mightily upon him.
That's right. And that's why this happened. This is one of the greatest, in my mind, throughout my life, one of the greatest Bible trivia questions of all time. Who killed 1,000 Philistines with a jawbone of a donkey? And, as a little boy, it's like, oh, I know the answer to that one.
Yeah.
Samson's the man. It says he found a fresh jawbone. Now, one of them says moist. How do you find a jawbone of a donkey to begin with? And then on top of that, how do you find a fresh or a moist one? I know one way. You can rip it out of a donkey's face.
Yeah. Although we're not told that.
I would prefer
not to think that that's how he got it. But we're in a rural agricultural society, and there's livestock all over the place.
That's true.
They're very used to having domesticated animals around. There's plenty of cattle and goats and sheep and donkeys, and so to come across a downer, maybe in the field, would not necessarily be unusual. And he just happens to be in a location where here's this handy weapon. And as we talked about, it's not the jawbone of a donkey who's been there for 6 months. This donkey died a long time ago, and oh, look, here's a skeleton of a donkey. I can grab the jawbone. Because we know what happens to bone. If you picked up a jawbone and started smiting left and right with it, and it's been out in the weather for 6 months, it's not going to last as a weapon very long.
It's going to turn to powder.
Yeah. But here's a fresh jawbone, so the bone's still supple. All of its strength is still in it. And Samson just goes to work with it. And it's a hefty enough instrument that he's able to just, I guess, knock these people down as soon as he puts a whack on them. Of course, with his strength, that's all it would take.
Yeah.
But what a fearful sight this must have been to the rest of the Philistine army. This guy's down there, surrounded, and he's just, you know, kind of like in those kung fu movies, there's bodies just flying away from him as he's standing in the middle of this crowd.
Like a Tasmanian devil. Yeah, as they're ripping through this crowd.
He's just tearing these guys apart. So.
And the men of Judah, too. Don't forget, the 3,000 men brought him and
they're
presented.
They're still there. Yeah.
They're still standing there. He breaks loose and just starts ripping into these guys. So, you know, however the Philistines saw this, there's still 3,000 men behind Samson. He's the one doing all the damage, but eventually they're like, well, we got to get out of here.
Yeah.
However many there were.
I imagine once they saw him go to work, they're probably, oops, he's going to be mad at us too. So they took the opportunity to get out of there.
Yeah. So he reached out his hand. He took a fresh jawbone. He killed 1,000 men with it. And then Samson said, with the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of a donkey, I have slain 1,000 men. And one of the things I had mentioned to you is he's wrong. The Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and he has to know that at some level. Whether he does or not is irrelevant. He takes all the credit to himself. This is the great and mighty thing that I have done. And that's very dangerous, and I think the spiritual application can be made for us. It is, you know, I'll let you speak for yourself, but it's very easy to move into that place where you say, okay, I've done a lot, and I've been working hard, and you can start to calculate everything you've done to reach a certain end. And what that does for me is it gets me to a place where I want someone to thank me or to at least acknowledge, you know, how many days I've been here, how hard I've been working, whatever that may be that I've done, that I want credit. And a Christian can't live their life that way, because that in no way does that glorify God. We did it, but we've got to find a way to incorporate. It's only by the blessing and by the hand of God that I was able to do it, right? Isn't that a better approach?
Yeah, I think James touches on that when he says, you know, don't say I'm going to go here or there and spend a month or whatever doing business and get gain. Rather say, if the Lord wills,
exactly,
I'm going to do this or that. And to have that attitude and have that mindset where it's become habit, you've taught yourself to think that way, that, hey, God's in the picture here. So if I'm going to go do something, it's because he's willing that I should do it. If I have accomplished something, it's because he allowed it. He gave me the strength or the resources or the opportunity to accomplish that. And so really the thanks should go to him. He gave me the health that I needed to do the work that I had to do to get whatever it is that I was had for my goal. So the thanks goes to him. And when I plan something, you know, I'm going to do this if it's part of the Lord's plan, if it's his will that I do this.
That's right. He's allowed it to take place.
That also keeps us in the mind frame of seeking his will. You know, is this the right way to go? And so we look at the scriptures and we study the principles that the Bible's laid out for us, and we can make that informed decision that, ooh, you know, when I sit down and look at it, I'm thinking, this doesn't really glorify God real well, so I probably shouldn't go this way.
Yeah, and when you make choices like that and the blessings that are born out of that, naturally you say, well, I didn't get here on my own. I've been studying the scriptures. I've thought about what God wants in my life. And so that they tie together, and then they can't be separated at some point. And I think the other beautiful part of that is that a person who stays there and continues to say, no, it's by God and God alone, that humility is a part of their life. That is humility, to not take it to yourself.
And I think we'll find when we make a decision for the Lord that way, that we're, okay, I'm not going through with this plan because I can see that's not going to, I don't believe God would be pleased with that. So you back off of that and you kind of think, okay, what's next? What do I do? God will open a door. And when you follow him, he's going to wind up blessing you more than what you would have obtained if you'd gone that other
path. That's
right.
Let him do it his way.
Yeah. And he delights in that. When you follow him, he delights in abundantly blessing those who have submitted themselves to him and are always mindful of him.
Yeah. And James tells us again, he gives to all men liberally. And that is takes faith on our part. So the man who loves riddles says, with the jawbone of a donkey, I've slain 1,000 men. And I was, you know, mindful of the point we made initially that he's kind of an oddball. He doesn't seem to have any friends at all. Remember, the Philistines offered companions to him. When he goes and gathers the foxes, we're not told of anybody giving him a hand. There's no other Israelites saying, that's a good idea, I'll help you, here's what I can do. Now, if he found some help, the Bible doesn't tell us about that. He seems to be moving all on his own and, you know, by the will of God, these things are taking place. But here again, in this case, we know that 3,000 men of Judah are standing behind him. He goes to town on 1,000 Philistines with a jawbone of a donkey, and they seem to stand there and watch, or maybe they ran away. We don't know. But again, not one person says, hey, you know, Samson's my buddy. I'm not going to let him do this on his own. He is absolutely by himself in every scene that we see. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. In fact, you mentioning there the idea, well, you know, he didn't have anyone to help him gather the foxes for his fire raid there. I imagine if someone would have come up and said, hey, Samson, how come you're collecting all of these animals? What are you doing? Well, I'm going to burn out the Philistines. No, you're not, man. That's going to cause problems. I doubt they would have helped him.
Yeah.
They would have gathered up some men. We better stop Samson, man. He's going nuts over there against the Philistines.
He looks angry and he's not slowing down.
So you're right. It just the only help he had was from the Lord.
Yep. And he needed to say that, and he didn't.
Yes.
He took it to himself. Verse 17 says, so it was when he had finished speaking, this is his little statement that he made, that he threw the jawbone from his hand, and he called that place Ramoth Lehi. This literally means jawbone heights.
Yeah. Hey, I just bought myself a house. Oh, yeah, where? Up in Jawbone Heights.
Oh, man, Jawbone Heights. I haven't heard about that.
I heard about, why do they call it that? Oh, haven't you heard about Samson?
They got a huge cemetery there.
Oh. Yeah, but the Homeowners Association doesn't allow donkeys.
No moss on the donkeys.
Yeah, maybe we better get back to scripture, huh?
Oh, yes, sorry. So he's now in Jawbone Heights. Verse 18, then he became very thirsty. So he cried out to the Lord and said, you have given this great deliverance by the hand of your servant. Well, there's some credit he gave to God. And now shall I die of thirst and fall into the hand of the uncircumcised? So God split the hollow place that is in Lehi, and water came out, and he drank, and his spirit returned, and he was revived. Therefore he called his name En Hakkor, which is in Lehi to this day. And he judged Israel 20 years in the days of the Philistines. And that concludes chapter 15. Interesting that he has the victory, and then he turns to God. This is the first time we hear him speak to the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered about that too, is, you know, being a loner, we know that the tabernacle's in Shiloh. We know there's a high priest that is in his proper position around this time. At least we've got enough information to assume that's all intact. And we don't ever see him go to Shiloh. We don't see him talk to a priest. We don't see him praying. And so finally, for the first time, and what's his attitude? You let me do this, and now you're going to make me die of thirst, you know, with his dying statement that he makes. This, as you pointed out earlier, is very reminiscent of the Israelite people when they were in the wilderness.
Yep.
You brought us out here to die of thirst.
Yep.
And God split open a rock and provided water for them.
Yep. Same picture. I was thinking that too. It's not the first time that God has provided water from an unseemly place. Obviously, apparently it looks like he opened a spring here that he made available for Samson. But either way, you know, he's shown that he can bring water out of a rock, bring water out of this hollow place. So God can provide, and he shows his mercy here to Samson. He hears mercy. Okay, you've acknowledged me as the source of your victory. No, I'm not going to let you die of thirst, so I'm going to provide this water for you. So we see his graciousness towards Samson. And as you mentioned, that revives his spirit, and he just heads on his way. And there, we're finally told specifically that he is a judge of Israel.
Yep.
With a 20-year judgeship that was designed to overcome the Philistines and break their bondage.
That's right. 20 years he judged during the days of the Philistines. Again, very sad commentary. The days of the Philistines. This is when they ruled over the nation of Israel. And Samson is leveling the playing field with his own bare hands and certainly with what God has given him to do. And so the next chapter, which we will get through in our next episode, we will watch the strongest man in all the world fall to the one weakness that he repeatedly showed in his life. And we'll get there when the Lord gives us time to do that. We have Bible trivia questions for each other and for those who are listening. You have your Bible trivia questions ready. You told me you did.
I'm set to go. I'm ready to fire the first one at you.
Okay, you can do number one for everyone who's listening with us, and I'll do my best to answer that.
Trivia, sweet trivia.
First one will be out of the New Testament. Who wrote, who said the phrase, "I know whom I have believed"? And who did he write that to? Who wrote it? And who did he write it to?
The Apostle Paul.
Okay, correct.
Wrote it.
Yes.
And I believe that he wrote that to Timothy.
Yes.
I don't know which letter, though.
2 Timothy 1:12. He says at the end of that verse, "I know whom I believed, and am persuaded he's able to deliver me against that day," or to keep me against that day. So,
keep me against that day.
Yeah, a tremendous statement of faith.
Absolutely. Faith. Man,
all
powerful.
Right. You're one for one, Danny.
Awesome.
Also a good start.
Let's keep track of that as long as I'm doing well. Your first question and the second question for everyone else. Before Jesus was conceived in Mary's womb, an angel of God came to Mary and told her that the Holy Spirit would come upon her and she would bear a son. What was the angel's name?
Gabriel.
Man, you answer these too fast. There's got to be a, you know, what
sorry,
they call
I gotta, them. Yeah, I do need to, I think, build up some suspense.
The pregnant pause is, you know, and it allows the listener to be like, I know this, I know this, I know this.
Yeah, you're right. Actually, I should give a chance for people to think about it.
Plus, you come off as not having any humility at all.
Well, I mean, you know, Bible answer man kind of guy here. Not really.
And I'm saying all of this, and as I'm saying this, I'm thinking about, I think, a week or two ago when you were asking about Jonah, and I was like, "Jabba," you know, before you even asked the question.
Yeah.
So I'm as guilty as anybody for doing it. Okay.
But interestingly enough, there are only two named angels in the Bible.
Michael's the other one.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
And Gabriel. And so Gabriel seems to be the messenger.
He's the messenger angel, because he's the one who went to Daniel.
Yes, he did.
With the interpretation of his dreams and what have you. And Michael is the archangel.
That's right.
The one who's fighting against the enemy.
Man, that's cool. So his name is Gabriel, and that's given to us in Luke chapter 1 and verse 26.
All right. Okay. We're going to go to an Old Testament statement now.
Do it.
I'm going to give you the beginning of the sentence, and you get to complete it.
Okay.
So this person said, "The soul that sins," and I'll give you a hint, it was a prophet.
Ezekiel.
Yes. And what is the completion of the statement? The soul that sins.
It's either it shall die or he shall die.
Correct. Yeah, it shall die. Ezekiel 18:20.
Nice.
Which is the whole point of that chapter. Ezekiel is a great chapter to go to see God emphasizing that we are responsible individually for our sins.
Yep.
I am not going to be judged guilty because of what my father did. He's not going to be judged guilty for what I do. We all bear our own responsibilities. And he also talks about repentance.
Yes.
That if you have the unrighteous person and they change their way and practice righteousness, God says, "I'll forget the unrighteousness.
They shall live."
And they'll live.
Yep.
But then if they turn from that, they'll die. So God responds to the choices that man makes and holds us individually responsible for those choices.
And the standard's always the same.
Yep. It's very consistent because he's God.
It's not a moving target. I heard a preacher say a long time ago that you can't ride in on the coattails of your righteous grandfather are your righteous father.
Yeah, you know, that's a good way to put it.
The good deeds and the service of the kingdom that, that he offered to God are of no credit to you. And and on the other side of it, that's a blessing because the sins of my father I'm not accountable for. So that's a very good passage and a great thought. Okay, the fourth and final question for all of us. Second one for you. We're in the book of Joshua.
Okay.
When the two spies came to Rahab's house, the king asked her where they were because he knew they went into her house. Where did Rahab hide the two spies?
Pause.
That's right. Wait.
Wait for it. Wait for it. Carole King had a hit song based on the answer to this question. Up on the roof.
Oh, I was like, man, what are you doing?
Here we go.
On the roof.
Yep.
Any other details you want to give us?
Well, they were hidden under, I think, sheaves of flax.
There you go.
Okay.
There you go. On the roof with the stalks of flax that she laid in order on the roof. Joshua chapter 2 in verse 6. Rahab, man, one of the greatest stories of faith. We're just talking about faith. That woman blows my mind.
Yeah, she's held up a couple of times in the New Testament as an ancestor of Christ, and in Hebrews 11 is one of the great examples of faith.
And James talks about it too. Yeah.
She totally put her trust in a God that she had only heard of.
Only heard of.
And it's amazing.
It really is.
And God exalted her with a special place in Israel as a result of that.
Yes, sir. We've reached the conclusion of Samson Part 2. We read through Judges chapter 15. If you'd like to go back and reference any of that yourself. And I think one of the greatest lessons we can take today is that instead of crying out to God, you know, I killed all these people with a jawbone of a donkey, the best thing we can do is say, I am the jawbone. And I'm a tool in the toolbox that God has created and made and cares for. And if I can be a useful tool for God and his kingdom, then all honor, praise, and glory goes to him. And I'm just thankful to be a working part of that according to God's will. So as you go out throughout this week and live your life and tend to the things that need attention, need your attention, the people you love and care about that need your care, and provide that in the love that God has shown to us. Be a living example of Jesus Christ and all that he is. Serve him faithfully with all of your life, and it is one thing you will never regret.